So I gave a title that was a bit long and in awkward English, and I think this is the informative summary of what I want to talk about. So when David invited me, he told me, don't talk about analysis. Okay, I'm not going to talk about manipulation or modeling, and I'm not doing whole brain activity. So this is going to be a kind of a regular talk about recording brain activity. So I want to talk about these things that we colloquially call surprise responses in auditory cortex, and I'll give you some observation on single neurons and small populations, and a bit about mesoscopic activity is a fancy name for wide field calcium imaging and fibrophotometry. Okay, so first of all, I want to say a few words about the organization of auditory cortex, both because of discussions last week and because this actually interacts with what the first slide of Tanya. This is work that is currently in the process of trying to get published with, in collaboration with Arthur Connert. The students who ran the experiments are Karsten Tischbirek and Taka Noda. So what we wanted to do is to resolve the issue, long-standing issue of the precision of the tonotopy organization in auditory cortex. And the experiments here are quite heroic. They start by using flavoprotein imaging in order to identify the tonotopic axis of primary auditory cortex. So here's they open the skull, and then they use a camera to look at the surface with the correct. This is mouse. Okay. Sorry. It's one of these metabolic intrinsic signals. Okay, the flavoproteins are proteins that live in, as far as I understand, they live in mitochondria, and so their activation reflects some kind of metabolic activity, and they have some advantages relative to imaging of changes in blood flow, blood oxygenation. Okay, so. There was a Japanese postdoc in Arthur's lab who introduced the method, so they use it. Okay, it could be also otherwise.
Not a replacement for calcium.
No. The goal is to get instead of intrinsic optical signals. Okay, instead of the it is like blood oxygenation or blood flow measurements. Only using a slightly different signal. It's also slow, and it's also it reflects metabolic activity and not directly spike activity.
So,
yeah. Okay, so you get these spots. There are a few hundred microns in size, and this is due to presentation of 4 kilohertz tones, and this is 32 kilohertz tones, and between them we interpolate linearly, so we get some kind of rough surface tonotopic axis. Okay, then they select an imaging field somewhere along the tonotopic axis, and here they do their magic. So they image all layers. I don't know which is preferable. They image all layers. So they use a small dye, small AM dye molecules. Okay, so they inject the dye first of all deep to layer 6, and then they image in layer 6. And then they inject again in layer 5, and they image in layer 5, and then they shift to a different dye with a different wavelength. Okay, so, and the whole thing is optimized so that there's as little neuropile contamination as possible, and these are relatively small injections, so It's possible to record activity from neurons without too much contamination from dendritic signals and things like that, all the way from layer 6 to layer 2, 3. So here's the typical, the figure that's always presented. This is one layer 2, 3 field. Okay, and you have many neurons. You can record the response. They record the responses to tones of different frequencies and different sound levels. Okay, and here you see two typical best examples with one very narrowly tuned neuron, okay, and one more broadly tuned neuron. Maybe slightly shifted in best frequencies. The best frequency of that one is slightly below 8 kilohertz, and that one is slightly above 8 kilohertz. You can do this analysis to all the neurons in the field, and typically in these animals, they are lightly anesthetized. You get about half the neurons with frequency response areas that are nice enough to determine a best frequency. Okay, now to the tonotopic axis. What you see here, this is basically the answer. Okay, so you see here three fields that have been imaged in the same animal successively in layer 2, 3. Okay, in each one of them, as if you just look at the median or average best frequency, you see a shift. Okay, from the colder colors, which are the lower frequencies, to the warmer colors, which are higher frequencies. However, empty circles are neurons that were alive, so you could see calcium transients, but they did not respond to sound, or they responded to sound but didn't have a frequency response area that was strong enough to determine the best frequency.
But they didn't respond to pure tones.
These are pure tones, only pure tones.
Pure tones, yeah. So they could respond to other...
They could respond to other stuff, but this experiment is about tonotopic organization, so the experiment was with pure tones.
Talk yesterday?
No, just in private conversation. That day one is not doing it. It's not responsible for pure tones. So why? Okay. Ask this question at the end again, okay? I'll get beyond pure tones at some point.
So this is just
I'm just talking, I just want to show this in order to have a common ground about organization of A1, okay? That's the organization of A1.
How many synapses is A1
A lot, many more than V1. And again, I'll discuss this in more details later, okay? If I'll get there. So anyway, what you see within each field, if you look at a narrow strip, within each field, you can see variability in best frequencies, okay? But there is also a tendency as you go along the tonotopic axis. So this is a general answer, okay? The variability within narrow strips is about one octave, okay? So neurons within a strip would vary by about one octave, but if you look at the location of each one of these fields and you convert it into a best frequency, okay, let's say, and you look at the median of the best frequencies of all the neurons and you plot it along this axis, you get nice correlations, and this is true in all layers. Okay, so all layers show the same variability of best frequencies, and all layers also show the same correlation, okay, of
distance between pairs.
The distance here is distance between the 4 kilohertz and the 32 kilohertz spot on the surface. Yeah, so this is about, it's normalized to about 1 millimeter, 1 point something millimeters.
I don't understand what I see here. It's a surface.
Okay, this elongated blob is the outline of A1 on the surface. Okay, this corresponds to the 4 kilohertz location, and this is to the 32 kilohertz location. Okay, each square like this is one imaging field, and the color corresponds to the median best frequency of all the neurons in that field. Okay, this plot and that plot have the same information in them. Okay, they are just plotted differently.
Okay. And this is a different layer.
And this is for different layers. Okay, so all layers look essentially the same in that respect.
And
Yeah.
Look at neurons that are kind of obeying the map, so kind of close to the diagonal.
Yeah.
Neurons which are away.
Yeah. So. Yeah, so one thing that immediately comes to mind is that the ones who are close to the diagonal are the ones who respond very strongly, so it's easier to identify their best frequency. And the one away from the diagonal are the lousy responding neurons, and therefore the distance from the diagonal has to do with the precision of determining this frequency. It doesn't work.
So there is no difference in the
I mean, it's not that everything has the same variability. It's not that the ones that are close to the diagonal are better tuned, more strongly responding, and more narrowly tuned, and so on. Okay. There are a few tens of neurons in each imaging field, and the total data set here across all layers is a few thousands of neurons. The total is a few thousands.
In
A1, there's about 100,000 neurons.
But the number of neurons that are actually used in this...
That's about half of that. What?
The numbers are small.
No, these are the number...
16?
No, these are imaging field. No, these are frequencies, okay, and these are imaging fields. Okay, there are 26 imaging fields in layer 2, 3. Each dot here is represents...
How many neurons extract best frequencies from each imaging field?
So, let's say 50 neurons in each imaging field, about half of them would have best frequency.
Okay.
Okay, and I'll just... the way that Arthur was very interested in the smoothness of this organization, so what we did here was to take these narrow strips and shift them and ask how far do you need to shift the strip in order to get a significantly different median best frequency. Okay, it turns out that if you shift by about 50 to 100 microns, okay, then you see already the tonotopic axis, the bias that's due to the tonotopic axis. On the other hand...
But that's a function of how many cells you measure, right?
Also, yeah. Within the conditions of our experiment, okay, 50 microns, given previous information, that's very little. Okay.
But it could be better.
It could be better, yeah, in principle. So, yeah, you're right. That's part of the conclusion, okay? There's no real boundaries there. Yeah, you need to do it along the axis. This was done along the axis, along the tonotopic, the surface tonotopic axis. Of course, because the comparison is symmetric, okay? The other direction in which they tested it is the depth direction of cortex. So in order to define a column, they electroporated layer 5 neurons and used their dendrites, the one that goes to the surface, in order to determine which neurons lie above each other. Okay, and if you now check the difference in best frequencies, okay, between imaging fields which are a few hundred microns apart, layer 2, 3 versus layer 4, layer 4 to layer 5, within the same animal, can adjusted to the location of the dendrites, then best frequencies don't shift much. Okay, so if you move 50 microns in the tangential direction, you get very significant changes in best frequency, and if you move 500 microns downwards, you don't. Okay, so the conclusion here is that there's a noisy tonotopic organization, and in fact the columns are defined by the correlation structure. Okay, there's no anatomical boundaries or anything that this is why I put the microcolumns in quotes.
So the notion of the column is continuum.
It's a continuous organization. Okay, there is a column in the sense that moving in this direction, you see much less changes in response properties than you moving in the other direction. But
is it different from the visual column?
And all layers are the same.
What?
All layers. Under these, anything that we tested here, okay, was exactly the same in all layers. There are no differences between layers. In V1, sometimes, in some V1s, people see sharp borders for directional selectivity, all kind of, yeah.
Orientation. In the mouse and in the rat, there is no, I don't think there are commons, even in cats.
For orientation selectivity, this would be rather the retinal location. It would correspond more to retinal location than to orientation selectivity, if anything. Okay, this is a mapping of the sensory epithelium.
I think this okay.
Yeah. So, but still, I don't understand. Is this the original claim was that unlike other things, the A1 is not organized nicely. I never understood. Is it different from other modalities?
I don't know. I know about A1. Okay, that's so. The conclusion is that at each location, the within A1 discussion was whether the tonotopy is precise or not. Okay, so the answer is that it is.
Call it pepper and salt, or not? The original paper said pepper and salt.
The original paper was probably, and I'm responsible.
Yeah.
For it was probably overdoing it a bit. But look at this, okay? That's a typical example. Okay, what you see here are all the neurons with defined best frequency in one response field. Do you call it salt and pepper or not?
I have to compare it to non-pepper and salt.
So the claim was that as you go along the tonotopic axis, there is a precise match between best frequencies of neurons that you will find and the location on the map. This doesn't happen. Okay, however, the way it doesn't happen is not is limited, okay? There's one octave range of dispersion best frequency. These are the facts, okay? How you now
going back to the visual cortex. You know, salt and pepper wouldn't be that.
Okay. I didn't
but I mean, salt
and pepper, salt and pepper. I didn't write salt and pepper anywhere.
No, but it's important. I think it's
important. Yeah, yeah.
I mean, theory string papers, we discussed it yesterday, and there are bold claims in the titles, and some of us wondered whether they're substantiated or not. And the answer is wait 2 years, or 3 years, or 5 years, and you'll get the real story.
No,
Chaim, is it the conclusion? Wait 5 years.
Chaim, the analogy is not orientation. That's what Ellen said. The analogy is real space.
Yeah.
And in the visual system. And in real space, you have this continuum. There's not a structure. You don't see, space is not broken into patches the way it is, say, the somatosensory system. As best I know from the literature, it's a continuum. And that you haven't really talked about something, even if it exists, that would be the equivalent of a feature like orientation.
Yeah.
It takes many spatial locations.
Yeah.
What is the
narrow tuning that I can do in the neurons? That's about as narrow as we can measure it. So we have here about 2 tones per octave. Okay, and so this neuron presumably has a tuning width of about half an octave. Now, half an octave, the question is whether this is a lot or not. Okay, so the frequency discrimination threshold for a mouse would be about a bit more than order of magnitude smaller. Okay, it would be 10% or 5% in frequency, not 50% of an octave. Okay, so relative to the frequency discrimination capabilities of a mouse, okay, this is relatively wide. Okay, relative to the peripheral tuning, this is probably a bit narrower. Okay, that's whole auditory cortex of a mouse represents something like 7 or 8 octaves. Okay, so again, that also gives you some order, something to compare this to.
How do you get a half an octave from that?
It could be many things, but strictly speaking, you cannot determine the tuning width of a neuron that had, it cannot be much more than half an octave because I have a tone here and a tone here, which are half an octave apart from it, okay? So The width cannot be much more than half an octave.
It could be much less.
It could be much less, but I don't expect if it would have been very narrow, okay, I wouldn't catch it.
How many of these best typical neurons do you have?
One? No, a few.
No, so what is the limitation? What is the bound? What is the lower bound from the experimental limitation? You're saying that
again about that half an octave. Yeah. That's my sampling. My tones are about half an octave apart. Okay.
Do you think there's not only white ones, just that much narrower tuning, so you're not seeing them?
No, I don't think so. I think that they're really not very interested in tones.
Ocular dominance in B1.
There are EE and EI neurons. I mean, neurons that are excited by both ears and neurons that are excited by one and inhibited by the other. We didn't test them. Okay, this is all free field, so the sound is presented to both ears. A lot of people do a lot of things. This is not very strong in the mouse, and potentially because the head of the mouse is so small that physically you don't get very large differences in sound level between the two ears. So No, you can do the experiment. You use earphones, so you present the sound either to one ear or to the other. But the whole issue of binaural interactions in the mouse is not very prominent in the literature, and I think this is because the effects are small, and this is because ethologically it's not a very important cue for the mouse. Yes.
Are you sure that the last statement is true also for
vocalizations
to other mice? Because they're
very localized
and closed by the social sounds.
Okay, I don't know.
Well,
there are also very high frequencies, so the wavelength is short, and relative to the, unless the mice are really very, very close to each other, in which case the issue of sound direction is irrelevant. Okay, the sound direction is important as a far field kind of a sense. Okay, it's when you are very close, the whole issue of sound direction is, you know where the object is.
Eyes are closer than the ears, yeah. So your argument cannot
fall.
Okay. I don't, I don't know. I don't think it's important, okay? It has not been studied much in the literature, okay? And we didn't study it. Okay, so let's get back to the issue of surprise. So why are we interested in surprise? Okay, that's a point for the philosophical discussion, which I would like to avoid. So I'm going just to make two statements. The first one is that it's Bill Bialik's fault. But he's not here, so he cannot defend himself. Many, many years ago, we had a discussion that led to some of this work. And the second is the practical point that the effect we measure are pretty large. Okay, so that's experimentally it's a good question, and we can go back to issues of why these things are important. And it's always come up with concepts of predictive coding and error signals and things like that. We can talk about these things at the end. So how do we study surprise? So this has a very long history. We didn't invent it. Okay, the basic approach is to generate expectation and violate them. And if there's electricity coming out of the brain, this is interpreted as the fact that there was an expectation and a response to it, to its violation. Now, these kind of things require additional controls, some of which we performed, but I'm not going to talk about it. So Believe me that these responses are reflect to some extent something that we could rigorously call a surprise. Okay, now the human brain is filled with these type of responses. The response that we are mostly interacting with when we are doing our work is a response component called mismatch negativity. So the way that it is generated is by presenting two sounds, one of them represented here by this color and the other one by this color. Okay, and you record the EEG, let's say from a frontal, between a frontal electrode and one that's on the mastoid. So it's an electrode that observes well auditory cortex, which is, and then you average separately the responses to the common sound and to the rare sound. And what you see is an extra negativity that is associated with the rare sound. Okay, and this extra negativity is called the mismatch negativity, and it peaks about 150 milliseconds after sound onset. This is a late response. The onset response in auditory cortex in humans would be more like this component, which would be about 30 milliseconds after sound onset. Okay, so this is the component that we like most to compare ourselves with, but it's not, there's a lot of other stuff that occurs when unexpected things occur, like the P300, which is index the engagement of executive functions, the N400, which is usually evoked by semantic violations, the P600, and so on. All of these things occur when a surprising stuff happened in the world.
Yeah. There's also kind of this passive surprise signal in P300, no?
P300 is a it's a complicated thing. It has many, it has sub-components and things. So part of it is a surprise, is a passive surprise, but the main thing is that it requires attention. So it's already, in contrast with mismatch negativity, that occurs also when you don't pay attention to the sound, P300 already indexes the involvement of attention.
No,
in experiments in which you try to measure MMN, you would actively distract the subject, okay, in order to avoid the P300 from occurring, okay, because once the P300 is there, it's so much larger than the MMN that it would often mask it. Okay, so what you do is to show the subject a silent movie or you know, tell it to do all kind of things.
And then,
well, it depends exactly on the experiment, but in an experiment in which a subject is not distracted, you would get around here a very large P300.
So you could still see, so you have this kind of run up, down, up, you can distinguish it by looking. All of these components you see by eye.
Yeah, after averaging.
Like the first one,
after averaging, look, this is about 1 microvolt. Okay, the ongoing EEG would be 5 to 10 microvolts. So you need to average about 100 repeats, okay, before you see these components. The P300 is already large enough to see sometimes on the raw signal.
So why is it interesting if it's such a small thing?
Well, ask the human, the cognitive psychologist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, fine.
Can you have PTRNet without MMN?
Yes, P300 occurs to type of things that do not evoke MMN.
For instance?
It's a bit subtle, but P300 occurs, for example, for omissions.
For what?
Omissions, okay? And MMN to omission is sometimes happens and sometimes doesn't.
So it's roughly independent.
It's not independent, but MMN would be one of those things that occur upstream of P300. It's not obligatory, okay? But you can evoke P300 in other ways too.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So MMN is the difference, right?
MMN is the difference, yeah.
So you have a response which has no name, and then the difference is called MMN. The response itself is...
That's a very long discussion. Sometimes, under some conditions, this thing occurs as a second hump. Okay, but usually the MMN rides on top of the so-called N100. Okay, this negativity is called N100, and the MMN appears as a more negative N100.
Okay. What's the N
and P? Negative and positive. Okay, you see here the deflections on the. Okay, and again, these are measured. The polarity is of the electrode you look relative to a reference, and usually the reference would be nose, or the mastoids, or another point that would be far enough from the brain. Here, what you see are difference between front central electrode and the mastoid. No, it's again, this depends exactly where the electrode is, because you need to observe well the dipole of auditory cortex. Okay, auditory cortex is here, okay? So you see it best when you compare an electrode here and an electrode here. Okay, electrode on the sides or posterior electrodes see these auditory potentials less well.
And you said it's a strong effect, so this is what you mean?
Not yet, this is AG. Okay, so we want to see these things at the single neuron level. Okay, and what I'm showing here is a fast summary of results that were collected over many years by my lab. These are all students and postdocs from that participated in these projects over the years, and also from other labs who got interested in this. Okay, so the basic paradigm is the same one that I showed you for the mismatch negativity. We present two tones, one of them is common and the other one is rare. Here I show the results from intracellular recordings in rats. Okay, these are halothane anesthetized rats. So what you see, this is the average EPSP or sensory response evoked by this tone, okay? The higher tone when it was standard, when it was common.
Wait, you're really saying at minus 80?
This was at minus 80. Probably there was a 10 millivolt error here, but we don't know, okay? This is a neuron, and the reason we show this neuron, Itai held it for, Itai Hershenhoren, okay, who ran these experiments, held it for 12 hours with a sharp recording. So he was very proud of it, and all the examples that he prepared for his presentations came from this neuron. But the one consequence is that we don't know what the tip potentials that developed over the recording. Okay, and this is the response to the other tone, okay, which is larger. Okay, however, this by itself does not allow me to claim that this response is larger because this tone was rare, and the reason is that the neurons are tuned to frequency. Okay, so what we do is present a second sequence exchanging the role of the two tones. So now the low frequency tones is common and the high frequency tone is rare, and we record the responses to the two tones in this sequence, and then we always compare the response to the same physical stimulus in the two sequences. Okay, so all the comparisons I will show you will be always the response to the same sound, okay, in one sequence in which it was common and in another sequence in which it was rare. Okay, so you see that the response to this frequency, this is, I think, the high frequency, when it was rare, okay, is larger than when it was common, and the same thing is true for the other one. Okay, this is very typical. Okay, the way that we quantify it is by taking the responses to the same sound in different probability conditions, and then you have something like a probability response function. Okay, and you have it, each one of these measurements provide these numbers for two frequencies, and we quantify the effect usually by the contrast between the deviant and standard responses. So this delta is the response to a sound when rare minus the response to the sound when common, and the sigma is the sum of the two. So as I get values between minus one and one, and when it is positive, it means that the deviant evoked larger responses than standard.
For which frequency?
For one frequency, yeah.
So it depends on
the... It depends on the frequency, yeah. It's not... So what you see here is a summary of two studies. These are recordings in anesthetized, extracellular responding in anesthetized rats. These are the intracellular data that I showed you before. The preparation was exactly the same. It's just the measurement, the electrode was different. Okay, and for essentially every dot here is represent one of these experiments, so a pair of frequency recorded in one neuron. Okay, and the dots tend to be in the first quadrant, so the example I showed you is typical in that respect. But also, the example that I showed you is here. It has relatively small effect, okay? For most neurons, the amount of difference, the contrast between standard and deviant is much larger.
And in the awake, it's stronger or weaker?
Here's in the awake. Okay, so this is more recent work. In fact, in the awake, it's a bit smaller. Okay, if anything, it's a bit smaller.
Surprising.
What?
It's surprising.
And there were two arguments, okay? One of them is, in the awake, everything should be much larger, okay? So this is surprising. The other one is that in the awake, you should see less suppression of the response to the standard, okay? Less adaptation, okay? And then you would expect the contrast to become smaller, okay? So it's...
also frequency?
What?
This is in the previous...
These are all pure tones, always experiments with pairs of pure tones, okay? And SI is this contrast, okay, between standard and deviant. Okay, so the point is again that there's a tendency for both contrasts to be positive. Okay,
yeah.
It's more noisy, yeah. Let's say, yes.
Even the response of the individual neuron, how do you reconstruct this average that you show in the EEG, which was much later?
Wait a bit, okay. The answer is that I don't know, but I will tell you, I will say something about late responses later. Okay. Yeah.
I want to ask how surprising is this effect, because it seems that the red one is pretty periodic.
It's not periodic. It's essentially a Poisson process. What we do is to use a random permutation, but of 500 tones. So. To all practical purposes, the tones are selected at each location. The tones are selected independently, okay, with the probabilities that we impose. We had a study in which we compared explicitly periodic sequences with random sequences, and part of the argument that these are really surprise responses is that the responses were smaller when the sequence was periodic. Okay, so if we increased the predictability of the sound, even when the probability of the deviant was 5%, so it occurred every 20th stimulus, still the responses were a bit smaller.
And kind of offsetting one, so for one frequency, the deviant becomes more stimulating, for the other frequency, it becomes less stimulating?
No, again, each dot here is represent it means that
for one frequency, the deviant
is more prominent relative to the standard. No, again, this is contrast between standard and deviant. It's not an absolute level of the response to the deviant. Okay, so if this point, for example, would tell you that for the second frequency, for the higher frequency, okay, the deviant was, the contrast between standard and deviant was larger, which means either the deviant is larger or the standard is smaller. Yeah, that's an off-layer.
In the wrong.
Okay.
One deviant was...
Okay. So one calculation that Nahum Ulanovsky did already in the 2003 paper was that if the effect is simply fatigue, okay, if the adaptation is a general adaptation, you expect the points to fall along the negative diagonal. Okay, so points that are on that side of the diagonal tells you that there is something, the stimulus specific, even if one of the frequencies is limited. Okay, what we don't have good explanation for are the points that are far from the diagonal and down here. Here, in all of these experiments, the deviant was 5% of the stimuli. Okay, these are 500 sound blocks, okay, with 25 deviants, and they are presented at about 3 per second. Okay, now, this is auditory cortex, and one thing that always comes when discussing auditory cortex is the fact that there's a huge amount of auditory system below it. Okay, and the question is always to what extent what we observe in auditory cortex is computed in auditory cortex. So, in fact, we know quite a lot about subcortical processing of such sound sequences. Just before I go back to the, before I go to the details, here is al regel achat, on standing on one foot summary of what the auditory system does. Okay, so you have the cochlea, okay, and the auditory nerve. The cochlea generates something that is like a spectrogram, not exactly. Okay, and then you have a lot of processing in the brainstem, starting with the cochlear nuclei and continuing through things that are called the superior olivary nuclei and nuclei of the lateral lemniscus and all kind of, where you have neurons that, in best cases, are highly specialized for performing a calculation. Okay, for example, in the superior, in the cochlear nuclei, you have neurons which are specialized for doing nothing, okay, getting a spike and emitting a spike with a little jitter. Okay, that requires a high biophysical sophistication. Okay, in the superior olivary complex, you have these neurons that compute the are sensitive to interaural time differences and the interaural level differences, and things like that. Okay, there are neurons that are highly sensitive to the onset of stimuli. So you have those who count a number of different features that are extracted in the brainstem, sometimes come to few tens. Okay, all of these are integrated in this huge structure called the inferior colliculus. So essentially all information, it's biology, so it's never all, okay, but 99% of the information that would go to the forebrain, okay, integrates into the inferior colliculus and reaches the forebrain from the inferior colliculus. To a large extent, the inferior colliculus would be the functional analog of V1. You have multiple overlapping parameter maps and so on and so forth. Also, in terms of synapses, the distances from inferior colliculus to the hair cells is the same as the distance from V1 to the photoreceptors, taking into account the circuitry of the retina.
What is thalamus here?
That's the thalamus.
What?
This is the medial geniculate body. Okay, it's the auditory thalamus.
No, but you're saying this is V1.
This is V1. Okay,
so
that would
V1
be the analog.
Input from thalamus.
No, this is a functional analog. Okay, it's not homolog. Okay,
yeah.
It's not the structurally it's the same. Okay, in terms of its function and coding, okay, questions that you usually ask about V1, okay, get. And the thalamus is above, okay.
I think he's asking, if that's like V1 in terms of number of synapses, what is like thalamus in terms of number of synapses?
Again, that's going too far, okay, in the analogy, okay, the analogy breaks. But here's the thalamus, okay. You don't know much about what the thalamus is doing, and then the whole thing goes to auditory cortex. And since this is V1, our tendency is to think about auditory cortex as doing higher processing. So auditory scene analysis, solving the cocktail party effect, object representations, things like that. Okay, we have...
Maybe what happened is that
The what?
The fibers cross, these slits that...
These?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the... No, this is the was supposed to be the reticular nucleus of the thalamus, reticular thalamic nucleus. Okay, that.
Oh, before you go on, so for animals that actually move their ears, the pinna, where do you get feedback to that direct the ears, and where do you get feedback that directs your heading?
So the place, the motor aspect in the superior colliculus. The superior colliculus would get inputs both from the inferior colliculus, so the brachium, and from the cortex. Okay, there's a space map in the auditory space map in the deep layers of the superior colliculus, and animals that do orientation movements towards sounds, usually if you microstimulate in the correct place in the superior colliculus, you would get that orientation response. In cats, that would involve pinna movement also. In animals that don't move their ears, you would get eye movements and head movements.
So the tightest loop is coming out of the inferior colliculus.
No. The tightest loop is the starter reflex. The tightest loop, the auditory nerve, neurons in the root of the auditory nerves go to the pons and from there to motor neurons. It's a disynaptic. You have loops at each one of these levels. You have loops. This is like the somatosensory system, and you have sensory to motor loops starting from here, okay. And at each one of these levels, you have loops. Inferior colliculus has a significant outflow to motor areas. Superior colliculus then has outflow to motor areas, and this goes on and on. And you have, if you already brought that up, okay, you have non-auditory inputs to the cochlear nuclei. For example, in my postdoc still, I studied somatosensory input from the pinnas to the cochlear nuclei. But more recently, we published a paper about vestibular input to the cochlear nuclei. So neurons that are auditory neurons are affected by rotation without sound. Okay, and again, pretty solid effects. Okay, so the whole thing is much more than just audition being processed. Okay, that's very early, already here. Okay, you get multimodal interactions and connection with motor reflexes. And okay, the tightest loop takes 7 milliseconds from sound onset to motor reaction. So this depends. Okay, the starter reflex is very non-specific. No, you do boo to the animal and it jumps. Okay, that's not. Not very sophisticated. The what?
Works. What was SSA?
Stimulus specific adaptation. Okay. So after I gave you this very fast introduction to the function, yeah.
So what level are you thinking about into cells that don't respond to pure tones but are responding to sort of note combinations?
I think that there are no such neurons, okay? I think that if a neuron responds to sound, it would also respond to pure tones, maybe weakly, okay? But I haven't observed a single convincing, in all my years of recording, I haven't observed a neuron that in the auditory system, okay? So I recorded in the cochlear nucleus, inferior colliculus, NGV, and auditory cortex, primary auditory cortex. So in these areas, I haven't observed a neuron that doesn't respond even weakly to pure tones among the other stimuli to which it responds. Okay, that's. But
even the mouse can distinguish well between combinations of pure tones and something which is a
low. Oh yeah, I mean the behavioral discrimination capabilities of mice are not bad at all. Okay, when Livia was a postdoc in my lab, we showed that mice have absolute pitch, and they can discriminate sounds in a single presentation sound with a frequency difference of about 10%. Okay, 10% is
that's
what?
Training.
Trained, but very little. Okay, that's so they had to get the task, okay, and then you could get them to pretty fast to low thresholds.
But overseeing, okay. I mean, typically, when you train animal to do discrimination, tongue discrimination, then both, it's still done.
If you do, so in our case, it was a single tone in each tile, okay? If you do comparison, you can go down to half of that, okay? Maybe 5%. But then for this, you need to train the animals much longer. So let's get back to the stimulus-specific adaptation. So we have information about stimulus adaptation in the cochlear nuclei. In all the stations that are colored in red, that are colored, okay? And what we know is that in stations that are colored in blue, you don't have SSA, and those that are colored in red, you do, okay? So in the cochlear nuclei, this is a paper from the lab of Manolo and Malmierka that where I participated a bit in the data analysis. There's no SSA. And things start to get complicated in inferior colliculus. Inferior colliculus has two major divisions, okay? One of them is called the central nucleus, and that's part of the fast, narrowly tuned pathway, the lemniscal pathway, what we call the lemniscal pathway, from cochlear nuclei to cortex. And it has surrounding areas where neurons have funny receptive fields and multimodal integration, all kind of things like that. So in the inferior colliculus, we know that this set station, the central nucleus, does not show SSA. The surrounding nuclei show a very strong one. Okay, same thing happens in the medial geniculate body. The ventral division, which is the one that projects to A1, the ventral division is the one that gets input from the central nucleus of the inferior colliculus and projects to A1, the major projection to A1. Okay, so the ventral division has very little or no stimulus-specific adaptation, and those other subdivisions of the medial geniculate body have sometimes very strong SSA.
And they don't project to A1? This is not A1 up there?
This is A1.
So there are
no okay, so the major projection to A1 comes from the ventral MGB, and the projection from non-primary MGB to A1 are these type of weak modulatory projections where the axon go to the surface and then go in layer one. Okay, so in that respect, yes, there are axons from non-primary MGB that go to A1. And so we can never, at this point, based on the circuitry, we cannot argue that SSA is generated in A1. However, the major auditory input, okay, the one that goes to layer 4 primarily, but also to layer 5, 6, okay, and so on and so forth, come from the ventral subdivision. And so based on this, okay, the party line is without a rigorous proof is that stimulus-specific adaptation is generated de novo in primary auditory cortex. So it's computed at least twice. Okay, once in the non-central inferior colliculus, and a second time in auditory cortex.
Like the Moore-Sherman type of idea that input goes through the primary thalamic nuclei to the cortex, and then to the secondary thalamic nucleus can be a result of.
Yeah, so the Malmierka group did the experiment, they cooled cortex and recorded in the MGB. So there are huge effects in the MGB, firing rates change, tuning change. SSA, okay, the contrast between standard and deviant doesn't.
So it's not feedback.
Okay, it's either computed in the secondary MGB or it's projected from the non-central IC. Okay, so to summarize this part, what I showed you is that SSA is large and robust in auditory cortex. And the question that came up, I mean, there was a question whether this is interesting, okay? So it is large, okay, which makes it at least a good target for research. It's present in awake animals, so we can do. It can, the contrast may reach one, so the standard response may go to zero, and the deviant response remains.
Okay.
The example was. I'll show you later examples where you have larger effects. Okay, but the summary plots had also these large effects. So when we started we studied the effect for 10 years before we figured out that it could actually be quite trivial. Okay, and we spent some time and still spend the time to try to check or to prove that SSA in primary auditory cortex is not trivial. So what do I mean by trivial, okay, or simple? There's one simple feed-forward type model that would generate, intrinsically generate stimulus-specific adaptation. We call it adaptation of neurally tuned modules. Again, we did not invent it, but we analyzed it and compared it with the data extensively. And the idea is this. Usually when you think about adaptation, you play a sound and that would adapt the response to that sound. But in fact, in the case of auditory cortex, neurons are tuned to frequency. So when I play that tone, it would adapt a response to itself, but also playing nearby tones would adapt future responses to that sound too. Okay, so this provides a notion of something we call an adaptation channel. Okay, it has a width, which in the rats we measured explicitly to be about one third of an octave. In mice, we didn't measure their width, but we don't expect it to be very different. And the model, okay, is simple. The cortical neuron may simply sum up a number of inputs, each of which adapts simply. Okay, and then if you present this sound, you would adapt its responses a lot, but much less the responses to a nearby sound. Okay, and then if you present the sound here rarely, okay, you would get larger response to that sound. Yeah.
So what's the relationship of this to the tuning curves you showed earlier on?
Yeah, so this has been measured very explicitly in cats. Okay, that's a work of Lee Miller and Christoph Scheiner. The cortical neurons typically are three times as wide as the thalamic input. Okay, that was an heroic experiment. They recorded pairs of neurons and looked for a direct synaptic interaction between them. Okay, and
but then you showed at the very beginning, you showed these two examples, one very short.
Yeah. So as I said, when Zach asked me how many of these are very narrow, I said one. Okay, the very narrow examples are rare. Okay, most neurons in cortex are more widely tuned than you would expect, at least in inferior colliculus. Okay, and the MGB should be sort of in the middle, but ventral MGB and inferior colliculus are comparable. So you would expect a widening of the tuning curve going from the subcortical stations to auditory cortex.
Because you mean you're ignoring the very sharp ones because you recorded very few of them.
Yeah. Yes. But, I didn't show you dependence of SSA on the tuning width of a neuron, okay? Which I don't know. But, anyway, okay? That's, okay, so.
I mean, it seems like you could be missing a whole channel of information in auditory cortex. So maybe you need to experiment in a different way. You need to have a stimulus at one frequency and then a stimulus slightly off and look for differences in calcium response, right? I mean, you could sort of hunt for the narrow guys.
When will...
picture if there was more than one narrow guy.
In a couple of years? We are gearing up to do the calcium imaging experiments now with these stimuli. It's non. There are many reasons why these experiments are non-obvious. Okay, no, not as simple as simply mapping the frequency.
So
response. Yeah.
So the simple model is that although neurons are body tuned, adaptation comes from narrow channels.
Yeah, that would be the trivial model. Yeah, what I think about is a trivial model.
Okay.
Okay, and again, Carandini was used it to account.
To separate adaptation from response. Adaptation comes from response.
Well, basically, you map. What we did was to use a lot of sound sequences with different frequency separation between the sounds. Okay, and fit a model. Okay, and from the model, this one-third octave number comes from fitting the data.
So it's not spike frequency.
No, it's not spike frequency adaptation.
It is the incoming channels which are narrow.
It's, yeah, well, the whole phenomenon of SSA is not spike rate adaptation, okay, to start with, okay, that it cannot occur at the level of the spiking generator of the neuron from which you measure, you record.
But it could be spike frequency adaptation at the upstream neuron.
That's exactly this model.
That's the model.
Yeah, that's the model.
But it's narrow.
Yeah, and you need your inputs to be more narrowly tuned than your target, the neuron from which you record, in order for this to generate SSA. So in a sense, every widening of tuning, okay, would entail SSA to the parameter over which you integrate. Okay, that would be the conclusion of this.
Why couldn't you have them more broadly tuned and then have some like different weighting that's not just a sum?
Oh, you can do a lot of things. Okay, the point is that because of the anatomy of the auditory system, this is an appealing model. Okay,
in this way, it cannot be adaptation of the neuron itself.
Because you reduce the response to the standard, but if you now present a different stimulus, you have a large response. Okay, so it's not the generation of the spikes that get adapted. That neuron can still generate spikes. It's just that it doesn't do it to the adapting stimulus.
Does it also work if you have the same frequency but different harmonic content?
These are all pure tones. In a moment, I'll go to broadband stimuli. Okay, so this would answer part of your question. If you do, the answer is yes. You get SSA when you have a difference, any spectral difference. Okay, I need to be careful, okay, because we didn't do the experiment. You get MMN for any spectral difference. Okay, this is in humans. Okay, and most of what we do in the cats for the SSA reflects also contrast that we know happen in MMN. Okay, so. My guess is that any spectral contrast would give you, and again, going back to here, to this, okay, when this type of adaptation would not happen to spectrally balanced broadband stimuli, okay, so when we do these experiments, we need to be very careful about spectrally balancing the stimuli that we use, okay, because we don't want to the SSA to result from the fact that the tokens that we use have different power spectra. Okay, so these are the Maciek Jankowski's, and Laila was a postdoc, Maciek is a postdoc in the lab, and Mori is a PhD student. And the stimuli that we used here, we call them tone clouds. And basically, what we do is to take a short 16 millisecond long bits of a pure tone and add them all together in a random order. Okay, every one of these stimuli has 36 of these tones, and these 36 are exactly the same frequencies, but at different stimuli have a different randomization. But in addition, to the total randomization, we also, the way that we randomized the stimuli was to randomize each six of them together within each octave band. Okay, so between 1 and 2 kilohertz, there are six tones, okay, with 1/6 octave interval between them, and these are permuted, okay. Between 2 and 4 kilohertz, again, six tones, and these six are permuted. Okay.
So the frequencies are fixed, but the ordering
time. The ordering time is permuted in each octave band separately. Okay, and this ensures that, and then we shift a little bit the onset times of each of them in order to avoid the periodicity in the sound. Okay, so this ensures that approximately at each moment in time you have one tone active in each one octave band. Okay, so that's That's the way that we try to achieve tight frequency balance. So this is one stimulus, okay? The duration is a bit more than 100 milliseconds, okay? A second stimulus would have another randomization of the same 36 tones in 6 octaves, and we present them usually at 2 per second, okay? So you have about 100 milliseconds. Here, I have an example. These are actually quite long for these experiments. Just a moment, where am I?
So for us, this would sound like one.
This is how it sounds like. Okay, and there are two of them here. Okay, there are two different ones in an oddball configuration. One of them appears a lot and the other is rare. What? Sacre du printemps, yes.
I only heard one deviant in that whole sequence.
There were a few, okay, not only one. Okay. Also, that was shifted here. This is the red sound. They start at 1 kilohertz and end at 64, and these things was shifted to 100, between 100 hertz and 6.4 kilohertz. Every frequency was there. Divided by 10 in order to get human sounds. Okay, the data I will show you were collected with NeuroPixel probes. So, do I need to describe them?
No.
Okay, no. Okay, we get about 500 units for in each penetration. Okay, maybe 100 will be well separated, maybe 30 of them would have sensory responses. Okay, but this is still a lot. I mean, 30 neurons per, well separated neurons per penetration is a lot. One thing to remember is that the neural pixel probe, I mean, it gives you a lot of neurons, but they're not densely sampled. Okay, these about 400 contacts from which we record span about 3 millimeters. Okay, so this is very much in contrast to two-photon microscopy that gives you the local population densely saturated. Okay, the neural pixels record the neurons along their length. Okay, and they don't give you dense coverage.
So the penetration is vertical.
So we tend. This depends on the structure from which we record. For auditory cortex, we tend to have tangential penetration. So we come from above and we push the electrode parallel to the surface. The main reason is that the probe caused damage to the surface, and so we want the damaged area to be as far as possible from the area that interests us. Okay, so we tend to push the electrode from far into the cortex.
So these 3 millimeters are on the surface of the cortex?
Or? No, they would be parallel, roughly in one layer, okay? If you're really lucky, you would sample, or unlucky, one layer, but this would, for example, cover the whole width of A1, and 3 millimeters is much more than the width of A1. So what you see is among these 500 neurons, you see a patch in the middle. Okay, which has auditory responses, and the rest are neurons from...
Which are not analyzed. So this is only the
We analyze all of them. So when I say 500, but if once I start to... 100 well separated, 30% with sensory responses, so part of the reason that I go from the 100 to 30 here, okay, is because the neurons are not in the... Yeah. Okay, so here's an example of frequency response areas. Each one of these shows the response of one of these units. X-axis is frequency, Y-axis is sound level. Okay, and these are all from the auditory part of this specific penetration. Okay, so you have more broadly tuned frequency response area, more narrowly tuned ones. Here the sampling is much denser. It's we have 6 tones per octave, so we can catch more details or more even very narrow frequency response areas. And this is rat, not mouse, but it doesn't seem like we have something that as narrow as a single frequency beam. Okay, in this case, sound level. Yeah.
Okay.
That's sound level.
There's a pretty consistent trend that the latter you get, the lower frequency you like.
I don't know. I mean, that one is pretty low frequencies, and that's a higher one.
No. Within one of those images.
Ah, so this shift
to the left. Yeah.
This shift to the left of the this is actually quite typical. There's this idea of on best frequency inhibitory subfields, which is on top of the neuron. So it reduces a bit the spike counts that you get if you go to higher sound levels on best frequency, but it does not affect frequencies that are far enough.
It's asymmetric.
Yeah. It's asymmetric to some extent because this V shape, okay, where you have a relatively steep high frequency side and relatively shallow low frequency side, is something inherited from the auditory nerve. Okay, all frequency tuning in the auditory, the typical frequency tuning in the auditory system is asymmetric.
Yeah. I just missed how you calculated this.
So in this case, we present blocks of that has 37 different frequencies covering the range from one. This is still pure tone responses.
It's not from the stimulus.
No. Yeah, that's a frequency response area, simply measuring the responses to pure tones as a function of frequency and sound.
These are these kind of double feeds or double best frequencies?
Yeah, they are.
Here, they are also in the
thalamus? I don't know, but I will, because we have these responses also in the thalamus. We have all of the data set I'm going to show you now in A1, we have it also in inferior colliculus and in the thalamus. Okay, I have partially analyzed the A1 and inferior colliculus, but we'll have also the information about the thalamus. Okay, so what you see here now are responses to tone clouds. Okay, so tone clouds. What?
Sorry, just point of reference. This is now an awake.
No, this is still these lightly halocyane anesthetized rats. Actually, these are sevoflurane anesthetized, but they are, yeah. We keep them as light as we dare.
You cannot do it's limitation of the neuropixel.
It's not that you cannot do neuropixel recording in awake animals. You can. We didn't yet. I mean, we got the electrodes about 8 months ago. Okay. In principle, and we plan on using them in awake animals. Okay, these recordings are still like all the rest of the, most of the data that I showed you in under anesthesia.
Can you just remind one thing, can you the tone cloud that you use between the standard and the deviant, the only thing that was different were the permutations, or you also changed the overall?
No, just permutation, the goal was to have stimuli that have...
The one we heard, it was also just the permutation?
Yeah.
So you freeze permutation, you repeat, and then you show a different permutation. That's a deviant.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what you see here are responses of neurons in A1. Okay. The two lines are responses to the same stimulus. Okay. The blue line is the response to one of these tone clouds when it was a standard, when it was common, and the red is the response to the same cloud. Okay, when it was deviant in the other block. The y-axis here is always normalized to the peak of the... I will show you firing rates in the summary plots.
That's firing
rate. These are peristimulus time histograms. Okay, so it's... I look at the spikes, okay, I sum and then smooth a bit with a 10 millisecond humming window.
And what is the kind of
What do you mean variability? Variability mean what and what? So here the probability of the deviant was 10%. So the blue line is average of 450 repeats of the standard, and the red line is an average of 50 repeats of the deviant.
And
Okay.
To argue against the model, you need that in your tone cloud, you don't have kind of frequency that are very close that occur at the same time, right? So like two or three. So then.
Yeah, but there are no again because we.
They were kind of
well.
Blocks of two. So for example, by accident in the deviant, you have more of those.
You mean a case like that?
Yes. So, I mean, it's probably not the case, but that's a quantitative question.
Let's go quantitative later, okay? I'll show you the data and then we'll go quantitative, okay?
So you're not supposed to talk about data analysis, but have you factored out the sampling issue?
Sampling of what?
That you have less deviant repeats.
So the way for the statistics, the way that we select the neurons is by the cases that we are interested in is very permissively. Okay, we want a neuron to have significant response to either the standard or the deviant of the same cloud.
But you okay. could show the comparison with the same number of repeats.
I could show the repeat with the comparison with the same number of repeats. Mm-hmm. And in principle, yeah, we do the analysis. So for example, you can take here not all the 450
exactly.
standards, but only the standards that precede each one of the deviants. Okay, in that case, you will get even deeper suppression of the standard. And the reason is that the first few presentations of the standards are before adaptation, and they are still included here. Okay, and also standards, you will see it in a moment, standards after a deviant tend to have to elicit slightly larger response than standards before deviants. So, no problem with that. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so I also have just a data question. Don't worry about the time. So, could you make a comparison, even though they weren't taken at the same time, could you make a comparison between what you saw, at least on the average, using spike responses in the electrodes versus the calcium imaging? Like superficially, it seems that the deviants here are sort of larger than what you showed previously.
Okay, so
anything else about the tuning properties, just in general?
I'll show you calcium responses. If I'll get there, I'll show you calcium responses, okay? And then you can ask the question again.
Well, but just even if we don't get there, I mean, could you make a comment? Do you see a difference? Do you get a qualitative difference or a quantitative difference between measuring with an electrode and all
yeah.
this entails and measuring? Calcium
responses
and all this.
There is a component of the calcium response that we don't see in the spikes. Okay, the calcium response reflects something that we don't see in the spiking responses. This is the point that I wanted to reach at the end of the talk. Okay. Anyway, these are selected to show large effects. Okay. Here are a few other selected cases. Okay, but actually, this is a population summary. Okay, so I have here about a bit more than 4,000 combination of neuron and clouds. Okay, for each one of them, I plot the rate of the standard on the x-axis and the rate for the deviant on the y-axis. And the large majority, 90% of the cases are above the diagonal, and red dots are cases in which the difference between standard and deviant is statistically significant at 5%. Okay, individually, the blue are the opposite. So there is a major strong SSA to the spectrally balanced stimuli in A1. Okay, just for comparison's sake, since I told you I have partially analyzed IC data, here are selected examples from the inferior colliculus. Now, this temporal structure that you see reflects probably hits of tones on the frequency tuning of the neuron. Okay, so here are again a few others, and this is the population effect in the population raster in inferior colliculus. Now there is slight imbalance between responses to deviant and standard. Okay, we saw it now in a number of data sets recorded in a number of techniques. OK, Okay, so it's not that there's no SSA to tone clouding in inferior colliculus, and we need to check more deeply what's going on. Okay.
So I'm confused. What is each point here?
Each point is a response of one neuron to one tone clouds in two conditions. Okay, the response to that tone
cloud. The color is the response?
No. So each, I'm
what
sorry.
What is hertz here?
Hertz firing rate, yeah.
What?
Firing rate.
Oh, firing rate. Okay.
Yeah, hertz is firing rate.
Okay.
Is this measured at the peak of the PSDA?
No, it's average firing rate over the 100 millisecond duration of the, yeah. Okay. Yeah, for the inferior colliculus, I showed you these examples. So for the inferior colliculus, the mean firing rate across stimulus is something that makes sense. For the auditory cortex, the response tends to be much more phasic. So average response over 100 millisecond maybe doesn't make much sense, but I have to plot something, okay? So.
Okay, so
the color was what did you call it? Okay, so the color here, each dot is one case. The red and yellow dots are dots in which the difference between standard and deviant was significant for that neuron on the individual test. Okay, so red means that the deviant was significantly larger than the standard, and blue that the standard was significantly larger than the deviant, okay? On the individual. Next point. Okay. What? We didn't do the anatomy yet, so this is mixed across all subdivisions. Typically, we go through the dorsal cortex and the central nucleus, and then maybe below. Yeah, okay, I can tell you that the thalamus looks much more like the IC than like cortex, okay, but there's still work to do there. Okay, now, a few other points here. First of all, the neurons discriminate between essentially any two clouds, okay, the cortical neurons. As I showed you, essentially all points are above the diagonal, which means that although these sounds are spectrally balanced and everything, and could even evoke the same spike counts in the unadapted state to the two clouds, okay, nevertheless, when you run the two clouds against each other, eventually the cortex tells you that it knows they are different. Okay, so that's a thing that, as an auditory neuroscientist, seems to me quite remarkable. As I said, the subcortically, this SSA to tone clouds is weak, and we have some excuses. Here, I want to shoot myself in the foot. I showed you the difference between IC and cortex, response to tone cloud, and so on. I want to show you what is the largest difference between cortex and inferior colliculus. Okay? So here is a response to one tile. Okay, there are a lot of units, about 500 units. Okay, this is a lot of stimuli. There are 5 or 6 stimuli along this time. Okay, and the stimuli are equidistant in time, every half second. And I dare you tell me where the stimuli occurred. Okay, here. Okay. Point is that there's these huge correlations, okay, population correlations.
Why there is no response for a second or something?
It's a kind of it's one of these terrible downstates of the cortex.
Yeah.
This is these are the tone clouds. So this is a deviant tone cloud. Okay, and the other are standard stone clouds, just before and just after.
Oh, even that one's a standard.
Okay, I'm sorry, the color here is too weak for the... I see it on my screen, but you don't see it here. Yeah, slightly pink. Now, here's another tile, okay? And here's another tile, another 5 tiles, okay? And again, once I look at many tiles, I can see that here on this bend, okay, where the deviant occurred, there was maybe a bit more response than in the other locations. Okay, but on a single trial basis, it's pretty difficult. Okay, here's inferior colliculus. Okay, where are the stimuli? Okay, there's no, I mean, this is a single trial. There's no doubt, okay, where the, that's, I put at first on this sequence of slide, I put the title of Why Everyone Hates Auditory Cortex, but when you record in inferior colliculus, you see responses to sounds. When you record from auditory cortex, you have all of these internal dynamics, okay? The, it's not only in anesthetized animals, it's also in a work. What? Same type of difference. No, 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 it's not. It's, it would be exactly the same for tones.
For pure tones, it's the same pattern,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, you have, we did, when you do spike count correlations between neurons, usually what you see is correlated zeros. Okay, when neurons respond, the spike counts tend to be much more independent of each other, but the noise correlation, if you wish, is driven by the fact that you have these joint failures.
And these neurons spend the whole of A1?
These probably spend the whole of A1, yeah. Again, I don't have the specific anatomy of each one of the experiments, so I can't tell you, but...
Right, and you don't think that's just anesthetics?
This type of correlated events occur also in awake animals. I mean, the silent periods are much less common, but yeah, they occur.
But wait, those examples you showed us for A1, where you know the first one looks like an off response, and then it's
which one?
That one, pick one. I mean, this gives you a very different impression of what's going on in A1 than your figures at the beginning where you saw, you know, a nice response as a function of amplitude and frequency.
Yeah, that's something I want to throw at the theoreticians.
Forget about theorists. I mean, just as a statement of reality of what's going on, you're saying that you're dominated by the variability.
Yeah.
At least as for this kind of stimulus you're using now. And the tones are really the result of a huge amount of averaging.
The responses that you see,
yeah, you showed us as a function of.
Well, but again,
it's huge variability.
Can you look at the variable part while we're talking?
Go back a slide. I mean, go back and put the stimulus. Right, here. Stop. I mean, you know, the first one you would say off response, and then all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
And. It's like saying you're playing baseball, but the pitcher's throwing the ball everywhere and occasionally at the batter. It's a different game.
I agree, but this is why I'm showing this.
But this should have been okay. Like slide one.
Remember yesterday I said one of the problems with experimentalists is that they don't tell you the truth. They tell you their simplified version of the truth. Here I throw at you something that we observed now that we did this new pixel experiments, okay, and that at this point, okay, 3-4 days after I saw it, I plotted it that way for the first time, I don't know what to do with it.
Wait, how do you know it? So you don't have recording from awake, so how do you know? It's the first time, so how do you know it looks
like? Such correlated activity occurs in awake animals too. I mean, we don't have 500 neurons.
Yeah, you don't need pixels.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you move forward a couple so we can see the different trials?
So here are two trials.
A little more.
Here are five trials.
What is the presentation number?
This is just, so again, these are, the way that I did them is that I selected a deviant, okay, and then I took the 3-second extent around it, and this is locked to one deviant, that's to the one that came afterwards. Okay, these are five successive deviants, and they start not at the beginning. This is not the first deviant.
This is neurons.
So for each one of these, this is neuron. Okay, this is time. Here, number two. Okay, so I have this part of the axis is again neuron number. These are the same neurons. Okay,
yeah.
So the axis here and here and here and here is the same.
Are there correlations between different presentations? presentations?
If there are correlations between presentations, they must be due to the stimulus sequence. Again, this is locked on a deviant. Okay, so you expect to see here on the deviant, you expect to see larger responses, which you do.
Ellie, this is so dramatic. Did you not see this? You see this in the calcium responses as well?
Yeah, so we actually have a paper on that. Okay, these correlations are higher in female mice after motherhood than before motherhood, for example. Okay, we published a paper about that. That was a major difference between mothers and non-mothers mice. We also tried in that study with the calcium signals, we tried to decode and to see whether these noise correlations affect the decoding, and they did not affect the decoding at all.
Okay.
I don't know.
No, I didn't understand. So the correlation do not affect the decoding?
No. In that study, okay, in that mouse study, the correlation, noise correlation did not affect the decoding.
Okay, sorry. That's the same. This is the same as this.
It could be.
But this is okay.
No, so I'm sorry. So this could be, there could be a deviant here. There must have been a deviant here. Okay, so this segment repeats itself here.
No, the dots are identical.
Yeah, the dots are identical. Okay.
It's the same thing.
Ah, okay, so this is a deviant. I'm sorry. So this, I didn't, so this is a deviant probably. Okay. I told you, these are successive deviants. Okay, so here I had a deviant. Okay, and that's the next deviant. It happens that this is actually the stimulus that occurred here.
So this piece is identical.
Yeah. Because this is a deviant. Okay, so I copied it here.
Okay.
And you see the thing that occurs afterwards. Okay, so
now,
I made a mistake here. Yeah.
Like
I made a mistake here. Okay?
But are there more like that?
Well, they occur on average every tenth.
Yeah,
every
exactly.
Tenth. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, there's this one.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. Wow, good eyes. Yeah, that one, yeah. Right. Yeah, so these are cases in which deviants occurred closer to each other than the window that I used to plot the case. Okay, I'm sorry. I should have checked that.
But okay. Now that looks like before the deviants, there's this big silences.
It's one example in.
N equals two.
Yeah. Okay. But that's the point, okay? The point is that inferior colliculus, as I said, inferior colliculus responds to sounds.
Another way of stating that the stimulus-specific adaptation is not important?
No, these things are independent of each other. In fact, these are tone cloud responses, but for pure tones, inferior colliculus show, at least the non-primary parts of inferior colliculus, do show a profound SSA too. Okay, the two things are also, I think, orthogonal to each other.
So this, you don't need a deviant here, you could just show...
Yeah. I could do whatever, yeah. No, the reason that I wanted to select... No, the reason that I wanted to select deviants is in order to show that when I now average across tiles, okay, I see something.
You could just show a long sequence of these clouds and show that the response to this gradient.
Yeah.
Either all or nothing.
Yeah.
With the same message.
Yeah. Anyway. So we know that the simplest model of SSA doesn't work in A1, and so one thing that we wanted to do is to study cortical processing mechanisms, and of course, we went to do what everyone else can do. So we do targeted recording from identified inhibitory populations, and we do some optogenetics. I will not show you the optogenetics, because that's the work of Tohar. So here's PV neurons PV neuron stained in with TD tomatoes, so in the electrode that next to it, and the typical spike shape, and here you see an ongoing recording. Okay, so again, blue is a tone presentation of a standard, and red is a deviant. So this is the beginning of the sequence. That's the first presentation of the standard, second presentation of standard, and so on. After a few presentations, the neuron adapts and stops responding. You see this kind of field this is a cell attached, it's not intracellular. You see a bit of these extracellular potentials. So now it responds very rarely to the standard. Here's the deviant, it responds to it. And this goes on. Okay, it does not respond to the standard. And here's the deviant, it responds to the deviants and does not respond to the standard. So that's a raw trace. Just to show that we can do the experiment, we can get good enough data, at least in one neuron too. And we did it in SST animals and VIP animals, and now also in animals, I don't have the data here, in the superficial neurons that express serotonin receptors, okay? So they are presumably a subclass of the VIP. Anyway, what you see here is an average of a population of identified PV neurons. Here's the onset of the sound. Again, blue are the responses to the average response to sounds when standard and red when deviant. So the PV neurons show stimulus-specific adaptation the same way as the all neurons, so pyramidal neurons. However, there are these sort of weak but pretty consistent responses that occur after stimulus offset.
What was the time? Can you remind us what was the time between stimuli?
300 milliseconds. So the next stimulus would occur here, basically.
And if you pinch pyramidal cells?
We didn't see, in these experiments, we didn't see these late responses in the pyramidal cells. Okay, the pyramidal cells had, if they responded, they had a single spike at onset. So these are just, I'll just skip that. Here's the average of the SST neurons. By now we have a larger sample again. On the average of the population, we see a nice SSA at the onset response. One interesting thing about these prolonged responses is that they tend to favor the standard. Okay. What?
And then.
Okay, and then the very late responses favor again the deviant. Okay, and here are the VIP neurons. Again, during stimulus, on average, you see a nice SSA, and then there are these prolonged response that seems to favor the standard. Okay, maybe later they favor the deviant again. Now, the PV neurons were quite homogeneous. Okay, they look pretty much all the same, but the SST and VIP neurons had heterogeneous responses, and we have a few cases, n larger than one, but not very large, where the responses looked like that. So there was no response at all during stimulus presentation, but after stimulus cessation, we got large responses dominated by responses to standards. Okay, that's the first time that we have well-characterized responses that favor standards rather than deviants. Okay, and they occur mostly in the VAP and SST neurons. Okay, so when you think about what these neurons do, like much of what we do, it doesn't seem like there's differences, no difference across layers, no differences at least at the onset response between the pyramidal and the inhibitory interneurons. Okay, the interesting stuff in this experiment at least starts after stimulus offset. Okay, and the excitatory, as I said, the excitatory neuron that were targeted in this experiment didn't show light activity, but, okay, I want, that's the last bit of data that I want to show. Okay, that's fine, I can. Okay, so we started to do calcium imaging, population calcium imaging. Okay, so no, not two photon, but these techniques that record the average calcium signal in many neurons.
I just have a question. I mean, the PV neuron, the particular example of the PV neuron you showed.
It's not an, yeah.
I mean, are all these, it had, there's a lot of misses, but I mean, could I to interpret this with the same kind of variability that you showed early on for the excitatory cells that you recorded with the neuropixels?
It could be. It could be that together with this spike, you had spikes in a large population of neurons. And in these cases, when there was no spike, okay, there was also no spike in most neurons, but we don't know. Okay. Okay. So, first, we started doing these experiments with fiber photometry. So for those, I guess all of you know, we inject the dye or use GCAMP animals. Usually we inject OGB into the cortex. It's taken by the neurons, and then instead of reading the calcium signal with a two-photon microscope, we put an optical fiber. And we read the calcium signal through the fiber, so it's a single large pixel that we look at. And this has been shown by the Connert lab in the paper in which we studied auditory cortex, that it reflects average activity of the neurons underneath the fiber. The reason we did it initially was as a control experiment for experiments in which we wanted to express GCAM in specific subpopulations of inhibitory neurons and see the specific average response of that population instead of targeting them one by one. Okay, but we never got there. Okay, so what I show you are responses to calcium responses to ANDIs. So what you see here is again this 300 millisecond duration of interstimulus interval that we have. This is the stimulus period. If I present silence and just average the responses to silence, I get this line. So this gives you what is roughly the noise level in these measurements. And the blue line here shows the calcium responses recorded through the fiber to a standard. Okay, so firing rate starts at about here. You see the increase in calcium level. Okay, and then after stimulus offset, there's a decrease back. Now, I'm going to show you responses over a 1 second period. Okay, so in this case, because we average here 450 standards, and usually they come one after the other, okay, you will see three very similar responses.
The gray line, if it is gray silence or widespread.
Gray, this is where the stimulus occurred.
It
occurred. What?
The silence.
For the silence, it was a dummy non-presentation.
Why did it periodic?
Because again, what I do is to take the 300 millisecond, take the calcium signal, shifted by 300 millisecond and average. Shifted by 300 millisecond and average. Okay, so I will get always periodicity, but that's the amount of periodicity that this procedure will extract from noise. Okay?
Is it strange that it's flat in the middle? That's just random.
I don't know. Anyway, that's a crucial thing, okay, David? That's the answer to the question that you had before. Okay, here are the responses to the average response to deviance. These are pure tones now, okay, not tone clouds. So during stimulus presentation, there's a much larger increase in the calcium signal. And in addition, we have this, I'll show you a better example in a moment, this additional late wave. of activity that peaks actually later than the standard response. Again, we calibrated it in, not in this experiment, we calibrated it in a series of experiments in Arthur's lab, and the answer is a few hundreds. Okay, that's...
So, it goes to one, usually the numbers are much smaller.
Yeah, the absolute delta F over F here, you see here five successive experiments, so... There's an order of magnitude difference in the absolute size of the signal. 3 is 3%.
Ah.
Okay.
Oh.
This is 0.3%.
Oh.
These are in percent. Okay.
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 I thought it's
a fraction.
No, no, no. It's delta F over F.
In percent.
Okay.
Multiply by 100.
What?
Multiply by 100.
Most?
No. Multiplied by 100.
It's percent, yeah. So it's the delta, it's the fraction multiplied by 100.
Also
yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. We always, oh, always, it's biological, always use the delta F over F in percent,
so
yeah.
There are three presentations here?
So this is 1 second time, the 1 second of stimulus present, of signal, and the stimuli are at 3 per second. Occur at 3 per second. So I
okay,
average here, but
okay.
You see also the response, the average response to the next few stimuli.
But it's
okay.
The 3 deviants are shown one. You have 3 deviants in succession.
No, I have no. I have here. There's a deviant,
okay.
And I don't have a control on the next stimuli. They can be either standard or deviant, and they would be standard or deviant at the percentage in which we presented the sequence. Okay, because these are Bernoulli sequences. Okay, so this includes 1/20th of the stimuli presentation that got averaged here were deviants. Okay, and
so in the blue line, in the second bump of the blue line, you included responses to deviants.
There's also 1 out of every 20 stimuli that gets averaged here,
okay.
On average, is.
Because there are more standards that are combined in the average, not because you adapt to a deviant, it comes just...
Yeah. This reflects responses mostly to standards.
Okay,
so the to standards that follow this deviant.
So and the fact that they're still different because the tail of the response to the first one?
So there are two things. First of all, it rides on the, in that case, on the decaying phase of the large calcium wave. Okay, and if you take this into account, there may be still differences that are due to the fact that these are standards that occurred after a deviant, whereas here you have stimuli that occurred after a standard. Okay, so the responses themselves may be different. Okay, usually a response after a deviant, a standard after a deviant evokes somewhat larger responses than the standard just before the deviant. Okay. The point again is the fact that you have this response that occurs during the sound presentation, but following it, you tend to have these very large calcium waves, okay, that almost invariably occur after, even after single presentations. So we recorded these things also in inferior colliculus. We did the dye injection in the inferior colliculus and pushed the fiber into the central nucleus. So these are recordings that have been verified histologically to be in the central nucleus of the, inside the inferior colliculus, not necessarily the central nucleus. As I told you, these are pure tones. So you see SSA to pure tones in the inferior colliculus. You see difference between standard and deviant. What we did here was to measure the time of the peak of the wave of the response to the standard and the deviant. And we compared these peaks, so on the x-axis I have peak, deviant peak time, on the y-axis standard peak time, these are the data for the inferior colliculus, and these are the data for A1, okay, trying to sort of argue that we have here indeed a wave that's does not reflect the dynamics of the calcium signals in the inferior colliculus. Okay, so that's a cortical wave. Same thing happens if instead of the fiber we use a camera to get a spatially resolved population calcium signal. So this is a little bit like the experiment, the technique that Jack Waters used last week to study V1. So we have here a response calcium. This is now calcium response map to a 5 kilohertz tone and to a 10 kilohertz tone. And you can roughly identify this should be the 5 kilohertz location of A1, and this is the 5 kilohertz location of the anterior field. These are the 10 kilohertz locations, and they go in the right direction. Okay, so 5 kilohertz is posterior, and 10 kilohertz is anterior in A1. Okay, and the anterior field has a kind of a diagonal orientation. And here's this deviant wave, okay, recorded with the camera over the same field. So that the 5 kilohertz location would be here and the 10 kilohertz location about here. Okay, and you see the wave which is occurs over a lot of cortex. Okay, it's a large wave and it's very widespread, spatially widespread. Okay, so it should reflect a lot of spike activity. Now, the last bit that I want to tell you is that we don't see this activity in the single neurons. Okay, so first of all, let's look intracellularly. So what you see here, this is again red cortex intracellular recordings. What you see are a lot of trials to the standard, a lot of trials to the deviant, a lot of trial in a condition in which the deviant sound occurred, but without standards, without intervening standards. Okay, and this is, again, a 300 millisecond time scale. Okay, so there's nothing special that occurs here, okay, that much larger for deviants than for standards. These are presumably pyramidal cells. This is data from, I don't think that we identified these specific neurons, but the few neurons that we did identify were all pyramidal.
What's the difference between deviant and deviant alone?
Deviant, as I said, deviant is with standard that occur in intervening trials. The deviant alone is basically the same sequence, except that the standards are replaced by silence. Okay, so you have very few, 25 presentation over a very long period of time, or rare presentation. Sometimes we call it rare rather than deviant alone. But so there is a slight increase in the membrane potential at late time point after stimulus offset. Yeah, but this is an average of a highly variable. In addition, we see it also to some extent in the standard.
It's not
special to the deviant. And I put this slide here just to show you that when we record. This is one of these fiber responses, okay. And the single trial effects. What you see is the average, as I showed you before, but also the single trial that compose this average. So these single trial responses are pretty much reflected in the average. Okay.
It's the average of the cells.
Each line here is an average of a cell in a single trial. Yeah, but it's average, yeah. So what I'm trying to tell you is that something